just for Peter. It would be something that everyone could gain something from. He was sort of representative of any of the rest. This occasion also was fitting for the opportunity for restoration for Peter after his denials of Jesus during the earlier trial before his crucifixion. And there ought to be also some lessons here for us. And so we want to think of this as we look at this text divided into a couple of chunks. And the first one is the heavy consideration of motivation for service. And I focus on the heavy because there was a weightiness to this that if no one else felt it, Peter certainly did. And so we want to pick up on some of that. Looking at verse 15 of John 21. So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." Now, that's an interesting dialogue right there. And it seems like, right out of the blue, Jesus is honing in on Peter and quizzing him. And so there's something for us to think about as we look at this passage. There was a question of personal love for the Lord that is indicated here. And a familiar pattern is repeated here as well, as we already had alluded to. They had enjoyed a meal together and then a time of teaching. And it was similar to the Passover celebration that became the Lord's Supper meal, the Last Supper, and the upper room discourse that took place after that. It was an extended teaching time, very significant teaching time, because it was preparatory for the disciples for what was going to be coming. And it is likely that this teaching time was with the rest of those who were present at this time, and not just Peter alone. It's not likely that he pulled Peter off to the corner somewhere, but likely that it took place in front of everyone else because everyone else needed to hear what was stated, because Peter wasn't the only one that abandoned Jesus in another context there. So Jesus also addressed Peter more formally here as Simon, son of Jonah. And in the Gospels, Jesus addressed Peter this way on only more significant or important occasions. And they were Peter's call to follow Jesus, John 1:42, his confession of Jesus as the Son of God, Matthew 16:17, and when he fell asleep, as Peter and the others, in Gethsemane, Mark 14:37. So when Jesus addressed Peter in this way, Peter probably realized that Jesus was about to say something that was important. It was like when your mom or dad would hone in on you and use your middle name. Do you remember that? That was intended to get your attention. Now, I was trying to think back. Do I remember, and you can ask my brother Richard if he remembers, since he's here visiting from Michigan today, if he remembers our parents using our middle name. I don't remember that much because there were too many names to remember. My mother would do well to even get several of our names in the right order when she was going through them. And usually it was a matter of just saying, "Boys," because you couldn't go wrong with that one. And she did use that on various occasions. But it's instructive to say it was intended to get attention. It was done so strategically, so that we can relate to. Then there's the matter of love here being a prominent concern. Now, we are familiar with this passage to some degree. There are two words for love that are used in this passage. But there is not a consensus on the significance of this. Jesus used a word for love, the one associated with agape, in his questions. And there are many scholars who understand this to refer to a total commitment to another person. But there are other equally competent scholars who do not believe it is as strong as that. Yet most scholars will recognize that there is a difference in emphasis between agapao and phileo, the two words that are used here, with agapao being somewhat stronger than phileo. The question is, how much stronger? Does it mean total commitment, or is it just a slightly stronger use of the word? So it's noteworthy that in this gospel, John did not usually make fine distinctions in meaning on the basis of synonym differences. He generally treated synonyms as having the same essential meaning. For example, John used both agape and phileo to describe the Father's love for the Son in John 3:35 and John 10:17. So if he can vary them there, Jesus' love for Lazarus used both words. Jesus' love for the beloved disciple, John 13:23, John 20:20, verse 2. Again, he could use either word. So he also used three different words to describe fish in this passage, and I'll spare you giving you the Greek on those, but I have them on my notes. Still, many expositors have concluded that Jesus was making a distinction between the meanings of the synonyms for love that he used here. The question is, how much is that a factor? And it depends who you talk to as to how much that is considered. Therefore, the debate over the meaning of agapao and its synonyms, it may be wise not to put too much emphasis on that distinction so that we don't lose the forest for the trees when we're considering the emphasis of the truth here. But yet, there's probably something to it that we want to think about. So Jesus asked Peter if he had more love for Jesus than he had for these. What is the these? It's play on Teuton here. What did Jesus have in mind? Was it the fishing boats and the nets that Peter had returned to, or was it the other disciples? The comparison seems to be more likely to have been the love for the other disciples for Jesus, since Peter had earlier professed complete devotion to Jesus in the upper room. And he seemed to be indicating that his love was greater than any of the others. So that would seem to be the more logical place. Because he had claimed that his love for and commitment to Jesus was so strong that even if all the other disciples forsake him, he would not. So there is that comparison that he himself had made. And it may be that that's what Jesus is playing on here. Yet Peter had denied that he was one of Jesus' disciples and even that he even knew Jesus three times. And that three times is the significant factor here. So Jesus' question wasn't unreasonable because of the context that we're thinking of here. He wanted Peter to think about just how strong his love for Jesus was. And would it hold up under pressure? How did that work before? Not so good. How do we hold up under pressure? Well, depends on the circumstance. Depends on whether I've had dinner or not. It depends on a lot of things. You know what I'm talking about. So Peter replied by professing his love for Jesus, but he used a different word for love than Jesus had used. Jesus had used agapao, do you love me? And Peter responded with phileo. And expositors who believe that phileo expresses a weaker love than agapao think that Peter apparently could not bring himself to claim a complete devotion to Jesus in view of his three denials before that. Those who view phileo and agapao as essentially synonyms understand that Peter was professing that he really did love Jesus. So you can argue either way. There isn't anything that gives a concrete distinction here. And so you can think about that. Peter wisely appealed for proof of his love to Jesus according to Jesus' knowledge. He didn't say, well, you know my love for you from my previous experience. Well, that's the problem. He had previous experience and he didn't do so well. So he said, well, you know, how can you go beyond that? That was wise of him to focus on it that way. It may be that experience had taught Peter to distrust his own judgment of himself and to defer to Jesus' judgment. That may be a good lesson for us. Is my judgment as good as it ought to be? Probably not. Too often. And so to defer to Jesus' judgment is definitely the wise way to go. So Jesus responded graciously by giving Peter a command, not giving him criticism. I mean, this would have been a golden opportunity for Jesus to really let Peter have it. I mean, isn't that what we would like to do? When you have somebody who messes up, that's your golden opportunity to just let her rip. You messed up, buddy, big time. But that's not what he did. He said, he made it positive. He said, follow me. And he told Peter to tend the sheep. And the word there is, you've heard of this word before, spelled different, bosky. Now you could maybe remember it. We have a bosky. That's a good place to tend your sheep in the bosky, as lambs. The lambs there is arnia. Three more pairs of synonyms, in addition to agapao and phileo, occur in this passage. There's bosko, feed, and poimaino, tend, or take care of. And that might be significantly different, but probably not. Likewise, there's arnia, lambs, and probata, sheep. And that, again, is another question. Is there a distinction there? Does that need to be considered as something different? And then there's the third pair of, or yeah, the third couple here, oidos, for to know intellectually, or gnoskes, to know experientially. Using the different words may not mean as much as sometimes has been made out to be, but it might mean, so we don't know for sure. So just be cautious as to how much we put into that so that we don't lose the overall point. Previously, Jesus had referred to himself as the Good Shepherd, John 10:14. And so now he was committing the care of his flock to this disciple who had failed miserably in the past. And so Jesus is basically working on Peter's heart to say, you need to be prepared for what's coming. Are you ready for that? Because Jesus wasn't going to be there anymore. He'd already given a lot of instruction during the upper room discourse, and now he is sort of bringing back the context, the situation, the area of failure, but he's dealing with it in a more positive way, but he's getting the point across very clearly. Jesus had formally called Peter to be a fisher of men, which was essentially an evangelistic ministry emphasis, Matthew 4:19. Now he was broadening this calling to include being a shepherd of sheep. Now this is a broader pastoral care kind of ministry that was included there. Giving some definition to what was going to be involved. And yet the concern about genuine love is in contrast to what had happened before. So, with that in mind, let's continue on to the next section of verses here. And he said to him again a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time. So what's the emphasis here? The third time. It's not on which word of love he's using, it's on the third time. It might be related to that, but that's the emphasis. Do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Interesting to think about what Peter was feeling about this time. Do you think he got the picture? You think it was getting through? Come that third time. Well, they say the third time is a charm, right? I'm not sure that's what Peter would call it. The third time was a lot of pressure for him to think through things. There was a repetition of the direct questioning. And Jesus had a way of being able to get right to it, not even, you know, with an economy of words, not having to use a lot. And he was framing it in a more positive way. He didn't say, Peter, do you hate me? Peter, do you obey me? Interesting to think about. Jesus asked Peter essentially the same question two more times, and Peter gave virtually the same answer each time. And as that was a cumulative effect, Peter was feeling the weight of it. I mean, with each time, he was probably sinking down just a little bit as that weight was coming on him, as it was kind of, he was catching on to what's going on here. Because that same question, the third time, again, this is the reason for Peter's grief that the text gives. Some commentators suggest that Peter was also grieved because this time Jesus used the same word for love that Peter had used, phileo. Was Jesus accommodating? That's the question that some have asked and wanted to think about. One commentator makes the point that the original conversation between Jesus and Peter probably took place in Aramaic. And so when John translated what they had said into Greek, he may have used synonyms for variety rather than to express nuance difference. And so where are we left with that? We don't know. We don't know for sure. So if you want to make a theological point, be careful, because you might not have enough information to validate your strong emphasis one way or another on that. But there could be something to it. At any rate, Peter was feeling a little bit of pressure about this point. And hopefully, some processing in his mind was going on at this point. So this was clearly a very intentional line of questioning. Jesus probably intended that Peter's threefold profession of love would correspond to and in a sense counteract his former threefold denial. I mean, you can't miss the three and three. That's pretty obvious, and the text seems to indicate that as well. Peter had denied his Lord in the presence of witnesses near a charcoal fire three times. John 18, 17, verse 25, verse 27. And now he affirmed his love for his Lord in the presence of witnesses, also near a charcoal fire, three times. Now, somebody could go to town on that and tell you that you should always have a charcoal fire there when you're going to make a pressure come on somebody. And I don't think that would be the way to go. Just so you know. So he has experienced the great physician in the process of restoring his soul. And so we use the terminology dealing with the elephant in the room. That's what Jesus was doing. Because Peter was carrying around the sense of guilt that he had for denying the Lord. And now Jesus addresses that. And he does it in such an interesting way. And he doesn't condemn Peter. He doesn't criticize. He doesn't push him down. He just kind of draws him out, gets him to think. And it was a very good way to do that. It seems that this was meant to show us that Peter is formally restored to his position and to be able to provide the leadership that the Lord had indicated in Matthew 16 that he would have. And it seems to indicate that genuine love for Christ is the motivating factor for Christian service. If you love me, you will obey, we read before as well, but you will care for my sheep. Now, there are other desirable qualities, but love is completely indispensable. Seems like 1 Corinthians 13 had something to say about that. Jesus seems to be playing on that. Paul seems to have recognized it when he wrote through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit in 1 Corinthians 13. Without love, there is no vitality about our Christian life and experience. One of the great encouragements of this passage is that a failed servant can be restored to fellowship and service. Now, that ought to be encouraging for us. How many of us have ever failed at anything? Really? Yeah. All of us have. And sometimes those failures are the most valuable experiences of our life. They are ones we wish we could forget, but we've learned something from them. I suspect that Peter learned a bunch from that. And just the way Jesus is bringing this out really brought it down to where Peter was. Now, there are some failures in ministry that may bar a believer from serving the Lord in some particular ways based on some of the requirements of Scripture, but other failures may only require maybe a temporary suspension from service or whatever may be necessary to bring restoration. But regardless of one's failures, one can always serve the Lord in some capacity, and we ought to be encouraged in that. It seems that Peter had now learned not to make rash professions of his great love. Did he finally catch on to that? Is that why he may have used a softer word? Because he thought, I am not worthy to express so strongly my devotion when I know I have failed as I have in the past. Therefore, he didn't compare his love for Jesus to the love of the other disciples as he had done before. He simply appealed to Jesus' knowledge of his own heart. Some additional observations. Throughout this interchange, Jesus consistently referred to the sheep as my sheep. Not Peter's sheep, my sheep. That's good to remember. That's good for all of us in ministry to remember. And sometimes I'm glad because I can say, they're not my sheep. They're yours, Lord. Do with them what you want. That's not really my problem, but I've heard of some who have. In addition, Jesus described Peter's ministry in terms of acts, not in terms of office. It was his service, not his position. Sometimes people get caught up in their position and fail to consider what the service is that they ought to be rendering. And years later, Peter wrote to elders urging them to apply these same viewpoints to their pastoral ministry, like 1 Peter 5, 1-4. In a sense, Jesus was giving Peter the same commission three times, only using slightly different words. And he was telling them, use your love for me as a motivation to serve my sheep, my people. It's clear that Jesus had concern for the flock that he was going to be entrusting into the hands of his disciples. Now, was Jesus taking his hands off of everything completely? No. What had he done? Or what was he about to do? Giving the Holy Spirit to be in the church and to be utilized by those in leadership as well. But he was entrusting, and so he was really needing to make sure Peter understood the weight of what was going on here. So he was likely seeking to impress upon them the seriousness of the task and the need to be focused on the love for the Lord to make it happen. And this task has been passed along to us, and we need to be united in our thinking in terms of a shared love for the Lord, our commonality in Christ, as a motivating factor for our service for the Lord as well. We don't do it for ourselves. We do it for him. And we're all involved in varying ways, in varying capacities of service for the Lord. So then we come to the next section here, the heavy consequence of dedication to service. When we get to the point where we recognize that our love for the Lord ought to motivate us to serve him, what consequences may follow? And here he's using "most assuredly" for the final time in this gospel, but he's used it several times. I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished, and when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me." Does that sound familiar? The dedication to service would have personal consequences. I'm sure Peter was eager to hear this. And it caused me to wonder, what was he thinking when he first heard this? Was he thinking, yes, this is what I've been looking for all of my life? Or was it, you've got to be kidding me. I followed you for this? And what would we have thought? So Jesus gave Peter a glimpse of what his future held. Again, this is the last occasion where this strong affirmation is given, most assuredly, so it's very strongly communicated. And it was a prediction of the type of death that Peter would die. Peter had just said to Jesus, "You know all things," and now Jesus is demonstrating that he does. And Jesus contrasted the freedom that Peter had enjoyed in his youth with the constraint that he would experience in later life. And some commentators have pointed out that Jesus was here describing Peter's crucifixion. Now, this is an interesting thought, and I can't validate this with certainty to say that this has to be what it is, but this might be what it means. It's been noted that the phrase "stretch out your hands" in verse 18 was a euphemistic reference to crucifixion in the Roman world. And this stretching took place when the Roman soldiers would fasten the arms of the condemned person to the cross piece of his cross. And the crucifixion of Peter at Rome is attested by Tertullian and other later writers. Origen, early church father Origen, indicated that he was crucified with his head downwards at his own request. Peter had been learning how his self-confidence led to failure and how he needed to depend on Jesus more. And Jesus reminded Peter that as time passed, he would become increasingly dependent on others, even to the point of being unable to escape a martyr's death. Therefore, Jesus implied that Peter would commit his future to God rather than that he should commit his future to God rather than trying to control it. Now, that's a good lesson for us. How often do we go to great lengths to try to control our lives, our circumstances, our future? And sometimes we need to recognize that God may have different plans in mind for us, and we may need to be open to other ways of considering what he might have for us. Later, Peter wrote that Christians who follow Jesus Christ faithfully to the point of dying for him bring glory to God by their deaths. You can check out 1 Peter 4:14-16. So Peter lived with this prediction hanging over him for 3 decades. Imagine that. Wondering, when is this going to happen? When is the thing going to drop here? Clement of Rome, about AD 96, wrote that Peter died by martyrdom. 1 Clement 5:4-6:1. According to church tradition, Peter asked for crucifixion upside down because he felt unworthy to suffer as Jesus did. We don't have documentation on that. That's his reason expressed. We just know that that's what is understood as having happened. Because he may have felt unworthy, and that may have been the reason. We don't know that for sure, but it's suggested. It's understood that Peter died in Rome about AD 67. History records that Peter suffered the fate that Jesus predicted quite precisely. Now, we rarely have predictions of our own demise. Now, if you are in a situation where someone is standing in front of you with a means of ending your life and telling you they're going to end your life, then that might be such an occasion, but generally that doesn't happen. So we don't know when. Can we live with that uncertainty? We know that some of us depart when we weren't expecting it, just as we've had with Mike a couple of weeks ago. We weren't expecting that. But apparently God was. And that could be the only encouragement sometimes in situations like that. I don't think it took him by surprise. It took us by surprise. We're still trying to sort that out. But we can take comfort in his sovereign timing. Jesus also repeated a previous command to follow him. And that was Jesus' original command to Peter in Mark 1:17. And it's stated in the present imperative in the Greek text, which is, keep on following me. And we understand that obedience to Jesus' command, follow me, is a key to every Christian life. Are we following him or are we following our own path? Are we doing our own thing? We know what we are inclined to do. We know what we ought to do. And we know what we want to do. And they don't always coincide. It's a challenge for us. And that's what this is. As it was for Peter, it is for us. So the idea is, as Jesus followed the Father's will, so his disciples should follow their Lord, whether the path leads to the cross or to some other difficult circumstance. We don't know what the future holds. We've been reminded of that. Then looking at verses 20 to 23, then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his breast at the supper, and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Then this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him he would not die, but if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? Now we assume that this is talking about John, and we assume that he's writing, and therefore he would be a good person to be able to tell us that he was still alive at this point. At the very least. The results of dedicated service are not equally distributed. Now that's a thought to think about. It doesn't always happen the same for everybody. And so for those who think everything must be equitable, it isn't. The prediction of Jesus piques the curiosity of Peter. He's thinking, well, if that's going to happen to me, what about this guy? So there's the question of the identity of the unnamed disciple here, but we've seen enough of this gospel and have thought through some of these things. It seems pretty evident that it has to be the Apostle John, who is in view here, and he veils his identity so that he can focus more on the other details. But he is very intent on communicating that the one who is writing this knows what he's talking about because he was there. And he gives us details that he would have known, like the one who leaned on Jesus' breast at supper, and clarifying what was communicated here. So that's pretty good indication, and he's emphasizing his eyewitness report that's given here. Another point is that he's indicating his close connection with Jesus, because one of the things he's pointing out is that John had a close connection with Jesus, the disciple whom Jesus loved. But he's also pointing out that he has a close connection with Peter in the process here, which would explain why Peter would want to know about what's going to happen with John. Peter was like an older brother to John, in a sense. Now, John had another brother, but there was kind of like that sort of relationship. You know, Peter, James, and John in a sailboat. You remember that song? They were up on the Mount of Transfiguration and so on. So they had this sort of this inner circle kind of connection. So Peter would naturally have had some curiosity about him. Now, Peter's probably not the only Christian who wanted to know what God's will is for some other believer. Yeah, you can think about that. How many have tried to run other people's lives or wish they could? We may want to know more information about other people. And we may need to listen to Jesus' advice here. shut up and mind your own business. Well, he didn't say that, but it may need to have been said. Jesus essentially told Peter that John's future was none of his business. That's not your concern. Let me take care of that, is what Jesus was saying. Rather than concern himself with God's will for other people, even those closest to him, Peter should concentrate on following Jesus faithfully himself. And the you there, you follow me, in the original is emphatic. You get the point. And even if Jesus had wanted John to remain till he returns, that was not a concern for Peter. And it's a reminder of what our first priority is. It's to follow Jesus. And sometimes we get a little confused on what our priorities are. The reference to Jesus' return here is probably a reference to his return in the rapture rather than the second coming, because that was the emphasis that was communicated in John 14, 1-3. And that would fit. Jesus' statement had led to a rumor that John would not die before Jesus returned. And this may be one of the earliest instances of people setting a date for the Lord's return. All attempts to identify exactly when Jesus will return go beyond scriptural revelation. We'd all like to know. We all speculate to some degree. When do we think it is? And when we have events in our world that are going crazy like they are right now, we think, man, it's got to be close. And it may be, but we don't know how close. It's a helpful reminder for us not to indulge in wild speculation about another believer's future and to focus on our own relationship with the Lord. So John clarified what Jesus actually said in order to squelch the rumor that was apparently circulating at the time that he wrote this gospel, and some time had elapsed in between there. And this clarification, it would be important because when John died, some people might have falsely concluded that Jesus had not been faithful to his promise to return. So John is wanting to make quite certain here that this gospel is trustworthy, and Jesus never said that John wouldn't die, so that if John does die and Jesus hasn't returned yet, there's no invalidating of what had been communicated. So that's why I think he is communicating this. And so Jesus is basically speaking here of a hypothetical possibility. He's not speaking of a promise. We need to recognize that as well. And also it's been noted that John's explanation of Jesus' announcement is sort of recognized as evidence that John was still living at the time of this gospel, and therefore his authorship shouldn't be questioned. That's also been pointed out that it's interesting and may even be significant that the last words of Jesus that John recorded here were about his return, because he's reminding us that he is coming back. Doesn't tell us exactly when, but he's reminding us that we can take comfort in the fact that this is the great hope and expectation that we have. Then, the final section here, verses 24 and 25. This is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. Amen. The life and ministry of Jesus is greater than contained here. He had reminded us of that earlier in chapter 20. The author continues to offer validation for his gospel, which has been noted at various times throughout the book. This is a final postscript. It contains further hints of the writer's identity. He was a disciple, and we're pretty sure we know which one it was. And his claim is that this is a reliable communication, that it is truth, that you need to take it as such. These things that he's noting here probably refers to the whole gospel, given its position and the emphasis. The whole text is trustworthy, and you can take confidence in the truth that's communicated there. And he was probably using an editorial "we," where it says, "And we know that this testimony is true," because it refers to the first person again after that. The author indicates that much more could be written. So the final verse, along with the one preceding it, returns to the broad perspective that that this gospel began with. If you think about the way the gospel is constructed, you have the beginning, which is a broad, general introduction, and then at the end it has a broad epilogue that comes there as well. The prologue presented the Word humbling himself and entering the world through the incarnation. And this verse presents the world as not able to contain all the revelation that the Word, the Son of God, disclosed. Interesting to think about those in juxtaposition. John's word was that this is what he wrote, and whatever else anyone else could write would only be a small part of what could be written to bring honor to Jesus Christ. And he's indicating something of the selectivity, because there's a lot more that could be done, but he communicated this for a very specific purpose that he had already told us that it was, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And I think he would want us, as his followers, to take a lesson here, that we also follow him, that we also tend his sheep and serve him. And so hopefully that lesson will stick with us. So next time we're going to pick up where this leaves off, and we will begin looking at the book of Acts. We want to, I don't intend to do an exposition of the entire book, but I want to do roughly half of it and summarize the remainder, and then go into some of the other topics that flow from that to get the bigger picture of the flow from the Gospels to the church. What is the connection there? What was involved in making that transition?